Paul, how excited are you for this?
You don't even know.
This episode is brought to you in part by DrawYouPicture.com, where you can get me, your host, to draw you a picture for pretty darn cheap. See what I've done for others and see what I can do for you at DrawYouPicture.com. Also, with support from Bluehost Hosting, where $4.95 a month gets you unlimited space, transfer, and domains, visit MovieBeatdown.com/Bluehost today.
Fly, you fools!
Hey folks, welcome to the show. This is the show where we're rediscovering our favorite movies with Blake Snyder's book, Save the Cat. This is episode 4, brought to you the week of September 25th, 2014. I'm your host. My name is James Kennison. Welcome, welcome, welcome. And with me is, we'll go around the table, John Steinklauber. How you doing, buddy?
You shall not pass.
Oh man, I can't get past you, huh? Well, Polly might have something to say about that. How you doing, Polly Godbout?
Can you hear me this week?
I can.
Awesome. Let's get going then.
For now. Yeah, let's hurry up and do the show real quick. Christian Sudrath.
Hey, did you guys find the part where Aslan was in the movie? I kept fast forwarding through it, but I couldn't find that part.
kept zipping through it over and over again. Well, I know C.S. Lewis would be honored, and so would Tolkien, for that matter, that reference. If you haven't guessed, we are doing Lord of the Rings, Fellowship of the Rings, brought to you in part by Pauly Godbout.
And woohoo!
Who suggested it for our list. If you didn't know, IMDb says a meek hobbit of the Shire and 8 companions, plus 9 actually, set out on a journey to Mount Doom to destroy the One Ring and the Dark Lord Sauron. Directed by Peter Jackson. Written by Fran Walsh, who also screenplayed The Hobbit, Lovely Bones, King Kong, Lord of the Rings. Philippa Boyens, Hobbit, Bones, King, Lord of the Rings. Peter Jackson, Hobbit, Bones, King, Lord of the Rings, and some really gross stuff from Australia back in the 1990s or late 80s. Obviously screenplay, he was playing it pretty close to his chest there with these folks that he's worked with on all his other directorial debuts. So that's interesting. Let's dive right in. The first thing we always do is figure out what the genre is, according to the genres listed in Save the Cat. I got a pretty good idea, but I want to hear what you guys say first.
I'm going to say, I don't know. I want to say dude with a problem because it just seems right, but I know that's not right. And it shows elements of buddy love, but
not as much as future installments. That's for sure. I think it's a quest. It's a quest episode or a movie, and so therefore it falls into the Golden Fleece category for me.
I agree.
Golden Fleece all the way.
Okay. Yeah. Well, where were you before when I asked you what you thought?
Because I'm going to talk too much throughout this whole episode.
Talk too much. So, it's a podcast. Right. If nobody talks, it's quiet.
Well, then you're all going to be quiet for the next 5.5 hours while we discuss the first 10 minutes of the movie. So,
oh, my goodness. It's
probably a good thing for me.
Speaking of the first 10 minutes, I did not even count anything that happened in there as anything. Like, and I don't know if I was complete. I believe I was right in doing that. I think it was laying pipe. I don't think it was part, it might've been part of the setup, but it definitely was not. For instance, I looked up and saw a student who filled out a sheet on this episode or this, I keep saying episode, this movie. And they said that the opening image was right there in that prequel bit, you know?
And the story of Isildur.
I completely disagree with that. I think it starts the moment the title sequence starts, right after the title flashes in the Shire. They're creeping up behind Bilbo, right in his title of his book. And so do you guys agree with that or disagree?
Yeah, I mean it's the prologue. I mean it's not. Yeah, I mean I think if you are flipping through the title screens or whatever you want to call them. On the DV or on the menu screen. There it is. I think it actually calls it the prologue. Ah. So yeah, you're absolutely right.
Yay.
So does a, a movie script have a prologue?
I think because it's written on a book and there was a whole book before this, I feel like they had to give some service to the kind Hobbit.
Yeah. Well, and then, like, I mean, there are a lot of movies that'll do that. For example, Anastasia, the cartoon, you know, from like the late 90s or something like that. You know, there's a little bit of the history that they do that, you know, is just kind of before the first song or anything like that begins. So yeah, it's not out of the realm of possibilities with movies by a long shot. I mean, we've already done Star Wars and, you know, the iconic opening, you know, scroll is all like, you know, laying groundwork, laying pipe, whatever you want to call it. So yeah, I mean, it happens.
And hats off to Peter Jackson for putting, I mean, an ungodly amount of effort and special effects into making that enjoyable.
Yeah.
Because he could have done the scroll. He could have done a narrator with text. And what would we have done? You know, we'd have seen a flickering candle and, you know, some parchment being written by Bilbo, and we would have just still been as enthralled, but we got to see, you know, all of this and how much money, I mean, dear God, went into just that chunk.
Yeah. Cried all the way to the bank. Now, I want to say something up front here because this is a trilogy. And so I know that they're based on books, but for the sake of this show, this is a movie trilogy. So it's kind of weird. You know, I know this episode is going to have a whole flow to it. This whole, Fellowship of the Ring will have a whole flow to it. But did you find that affecting you at all when you were watching it and thinking, well, this and the Return of the Kings, or I think that's what it is, this is going to happen. So that's why this happens here.
Yeah, I would say absolutely. Yeah. I even had a person online, one of our fans, listeners, said, you know, maybe this one doesn't have the typical, you know, beats. Because I mentioned I was struggling with it, as I always do. He says, maybe it doesn't have the typical beats. I'm like, no, they're there. They're there. But I'm finding myself, I was in a conversation with my wife about the Harry Potter movie series, which are 7+ movies, you know. And what I found is every movie does have its beats, but
it also, like
the Dinocons, you know, that come together, the Constructicons come together and make this giant robot. The first movie of Harry Potter is also the setup for the entire story.
Yeah.
Which is absolutely, it doesn't make it harder necessarily. It just makes you more impressed with the genius that goes into making these films and these series.
For me, it made it kind of hard to separate the themes because the whole time I was watching it, you know, I had the other two movies and I guess now the Hobbit movies in my head. And it's sort of, you know, it was hard to separate the themes or not hard, but harder, I guess, than if I didn't have any other knowledge, I would say. I don't know if that makes any sense.
Paul? Yeah, that makes perfect sense. And see, so the interesting thing with this too is that Tolkien originally wrote the book as one long story. And so if you actually have like a box set or anything like that, you'll find that The Two Towers, the second book, it doesn't start on page one. It starts on page like 419 or something because, you know, it was his publisher that wanted to break it up. And so, you know, he did want it to be taken all together. So I think that Tolkien would have been appalled by the fact that it was turned into a movie. And in fact, I think I read an interview once with his son where he said his dad refused to let that happen for a number of different reasons. You know, but even with reading the books, like they are definitely like there is that structure. I mean, Tolkien is a master storyteller. And if you read, you know, through the books, they're actually, it'll say like book one, book two. And so it's like, even he knew that you have to kind of break these up into almost like episodic pieces, so to speak, because it is such a long story. It's kind of like I'll give you a quick example. How I Met Your Mother is, you know, a great sitcom when it comes to this idea, because every season is one story, but each individual episode is kind of like, you know, a chapter or a scene that they all play out together. And so you can watch an individual episode, get that, you know, get everything out of it. It's got all of its beats and all that stuff, but they all play a role in the meta narrative or whatever you want to call it kind of thing. And so I feel like they do that with,
I liked Constructicons better, but go ahead. Meta narrative would work.
I was thinking Voltron. So.
Well, I would like to retract my statement and go with Constructicon or whatever. I think I might've changed it now too, but anyway, but yeah, no. So I think that you guys are absolutely right that it's hard to separate that. But I think, you know, part of the reason why it's so hard is because it's not supposed to be separated. And so the filmmakers had to find ways to do that. And I think that they did a really good job. And speaking as somebody who loves, loves, loves these books and has read the books countless times, I think these movies are great. So I think they did a good job of translating it.
Well, yeah, there couldn't have been a better guy to do it. And I think he they knew that. They spent a lot of times, I remember when the movie came out, really playing off the fact that he was a nerd, a geek, a total Lord of the Rings fan and all that, because they knew, much like VeggieTale fans are doing right now over the new VeggieTales, that any changes from the original book, you know, just like Harry Potter fans for that matter, or anything else, was going to be, you know, there was going to be some lashback. Honestly, though, I think because it was Lord of the Rings and it was Tolkien, that there are people that read it. But I guarantee a lot more people had not. And
yeah, I agree with you. And I'll just say this, and I look at this with any book that's turned into a movie. If the movie's done well, then it's a gateway back to the book. And so I think that that's a win. And so that's the way that I feel about these movies. That's exactly it. It's like, I think that you can watch these movies, get a general idea of the story. You're going to know all the main stuff. And then if you do go back and actually read the books, then you're just going to be filled in on all these other details. And you're just, it's going to actually infuse the movie watching experience that much more for you. So I'm always grateful whenever somebody does a good film adaptation.
Good deal. All right. Well, we're agreed. Let's jump from the genre right into the protagonist, obviously Frodo Baggins. But are there any other, this one was a hard one for me because he's obviously the main character, but only by like a half inch, you know? And I don't mean height wise. I mean, just like everybody is a main character. Everybody has a flaw. Everybody has to come into contact with the ring and is tested by it. What are your thoughts on that?
I agree. Always know that throughout this whole thing, I'm probably going to be the last one to talk because I've got so much to
please
say.
Just
so
talk.
Please don't wait for me.
Please just talk.
I totally agree that there were, you know, it was hard to say Frodo was a main character, but for the sake of not wanting to type it all out, I put him as the main, or as the protagonist, rather. Mm-hmm. And for his, are we talking about flaws yet?
Yeah.
I put just that he's a hobbit is sort of his flaw because...
Ooh, racist. I like that.
Yeah, right? speciest. Just because in comparison to everyone else, hobbits are sort of portrayed as just not really suited for the adventure a whole. I mean, I know Gandalf has a lot to say about that, but, you know, he's definitely not like the toughest or necessarily the most experienced or most powerful out of all the characters. So as far as his mission goes, I put that as his disadvantage, just that he's just not really even, like genetically.
I know what you're saying. I totally get it. I found myself telling my wife that it was his hobbitness that actually set him apart and above everyone else, because the ring in anybody else's hands would immediately start doing evil through them. But hobbits are so careful, you know, they just grow things and they get along with each other, and they, you know, their biggest problem is probably gossip, you know, and
there's two breakfasts.
Yeah. And dinners and seconsies and all that stuff. So that's the reason why he was the ring bearer. And that's why, you know, it took 500 years for Precious Dude to become what he was. And Bilbo was 80 years in, and able to still hold on to it without it dramatically changing him. I mean, it did affect him, obviously, which was, if I remember, was mostly in the movie, not in the book. Yeah. Anyway, I saw his flaw, honestly, as, what Bilbo mentioned about him to Gandalf, which was his heart was in the Shire.
Absolutely.
Well, he's a homebody. I'll just be going then. And,
oh, no, I'm finally right about something.
I look forward to listening to this later.
Christian, you're absolutely right, Christian, because that's part of, I mean, the identity of hobbits is that even when Frodo and Gandalf are riding in the cart in the beginning, you know, he says, you know, we Bagginses, you know, we're well respected until you came along and were labeled a disturber of the peace. Like, we never had any adventures of our own. He even says, so that's a part of, if you want to get really nerdy, that's, you know, part of, his Brandy Buck nature is to be, you know, a homebody into, and then, but that's a kind of a characteristic of all hobbits, is that they just go about their business and that they are ignorable and they pride themselves on those things. So you're both right. You're just expounding on different, you know, different parts of the rightness.
Yeah. Well, they do need protecting, obviously. And he was willing to go. He was brave, if not clueless, because he says, I don't know the way. So yeah, his hobbitness is definitely one of them. I just guess in line with themes and what I saw playing out through the whole thing, I always try to go with that as what his flaw was. And he, you know, you see that play out. His heart is in the Shire. Even when he looks in the mirror much later in the movie with the Ice Queen from Narnia. Mm-hmm. that's where the lion was, by the way. But you know, what does he see? He sees his beloved Shire, you know, the people enslaved, the place burned to the ground, and a really bad matte painting of the remains. but yeah, any other thoughts on the flaw?
Yeah. First of all, her name was Galadriel. Anyway, second of all, one thing to kind of keep in mind and, is that, you know, think about the, you know, the process of most movies, because it is a story arc, it's development, you know, for the character. It usually is the case that their flaw ends up being their strength, and part of the story arc is them coming to accept who they are, and once they accept who they are, that, you know, that enables them to actually move on into, you know, or to break into three, and that's usually where the resolution lies. And so with this, it's both his flaw, but it, like you've already said, James, it's also, you know, his strength is the fact that he is so innocent. And that's a key word for a lot of hobbits, is that they are innocent. And so the innocence prevents him from being affected by the ring. I mean, he's the only one, if you notice in the very beginning, you know, when Bilbo leaves the ring on the ground, he comes in and, or, well, I should back up real quick. When Gandalf reaches down to touch the ring, he instantly sees the eye and he knows not to touch it. But Frodo just picks it up and is like, huh, oh, yeah, it's Bilbo's,
it's like a
ring.
Pebble.
And, exactly. And so it is his weakness, because he's naive. He doesn't know what he's in for. He has no idea how dangerous all this is. It's, you know, his naivete is what allows him to actually wander into this adventure. But at the same time, it's also what protects him, you know, from the power of the ring, like you've already stated. So,
and he was so protected that when he went to look for it, it's in the bottom of a chest in an envelope. I love that it's down there with his junk mail, you know?
Yeah.
All right. Antagonist and flaw. The obvious choice for me was the Eye of Sauron, but I found myself saying, no, you know, yes, he is the overall bad guy. But I what I saw really affecting people and people really being tortured with was the ring. Any thoughts?
Absolutely.
That's exactly what I have.
Good.
Yeah, absolutely. And the cool thing is, because, I mean, part of the ring lore, and they even go into this in the movie, so I feel the freedom to say this without sounding too much like a nerd, but, you know, is that Sauron pours himself and his will into the ring. And so that's why, as long as the ring is not destroyed, he still exists in some form. And it's only when the ring itself is destroyed that he will be destroyed. So you're right in both saying it's the ring and Sauron, because they're, in a lot of ways, they are one and the same.
Yeah, the ring's the reason Sauron's even still around. It's like a Horcrux, man, from Harry Potter. It's the same thing.
It took a lot from Harry Potter. The whole story did, really.
I know. My wife and I were trying to go through it, because she helps me, you know, with a fresh mind. She can see things that I can't because I look too hard. Yeah, and she says, okay, I'm completely confusing it with rings and swords and capes and Horcruxes. So,
which, I mean, I think that's a perfect illustration of the whole idea of, you know, storytelling is universal. It, like, you, when you first think about Harry Potter and Lord of the Rings, you don't necessarily make that connection. You might say, oh yeah, they're fantasies. But whenever it comes to actually, like, how the stories are told, this is proof that good stories follow this, you know, this beat sheet. And that doesn't take away from its originality. It adds to, you know, the way the story is told. So
what's the ring's flaw?
That I got stuck with a hobbit.
It's made out of gold or something.
It's that it has to be like on some. I mean, I don't know. It's just the fact that it's a ring and not like a person, I guess.
I kept thinking it wanted to be discovered. That was the thing that I kept seeing over and over. Even in the mirror, the thing leans toward the Eye of Sauron. It tries to make him call out to the Black Riders. But it's so desperate to be discovered that it will settle for anybody, including a freaking screwed up hobbit from the bottom of a, you know, his own desire to be back where he was supposed to be is what messed up that king dude. I know all the names, by the way.
Isildur.
Yeah. And, you know, the ring got itself into its own problems, you know, and you do see that it has a will. It has a way of manipulating people. And I put basically that his flaw was that he needed somebody, you know, he needed to be discovered.
Absolutely. The only tweak that I would make to that is he doesn't settle for Smaugul or for any of the hobbits, because there's even the discussion where Gandalf says, you know, something happened that the ring, or in the movie it's not Gandalf, I think it's the narrator in the opening. Yeah, thank you. That something happened that the ring didn't intend, right. Which is it was picked up by the most unlikely of heroes, you know, Bilbo of the Shire. And again, that's another big
but theme. let me put in though that the ring betrayed Smaugul, it said, absolutely. Right before that. And so again, my point being that the ring is so eager to manipulate and it's so eager to get where it's supposed to go in that it got itself in trouble more than once. Anyway, that's all I'm saying. It's a flaw. That's all.
Yeah. And I agree.
Go ahead though. You said the thing.
Well, no, because I think that if I elaborate, I'm crossing over into what, I honestly, if I elaborate anymore, I'm going to cross over into the book and out of the movie, and that's not what we're here to talk about. So.
Good. Thank you. Opening image. We already said it happened, you know, after the prologue, right after the title. I had written that it was the safety and warmness of the Shire home specifically, especially Bilbo's house, which is a theme, in my opinion, that runs through the movie. Go ahead. What do you think?
I think the fact that they zoom in on Frodo sitting in lush green pastures underneath the shade of a fully grown tree, relaxing and actually, like I've already said, sitting down, like all of those things are just part of the opening image. Because it'll come back into play for the mirror image at the end. So I'm establishing those things.
Sitting down is a good, I didn't think about that because there's not a lot of that going on after.
No.
Yeah.
That's a good point.
Nobody poops. Nobody poops either.
Everybody poops.
Yeah. They waited till the Mines of Moria.
Yeah.
Lots of places to go there. Privacy.
Darkness.
Yeah, the opening image was definitely that warmth. I remember that from the beginning. I feel it every time I watch the movie. These houses are lived in. They are homey. I mean, if you walked in there, even if you were too tall to walk around, you would feel comfortable. Well, there would be something cooking on the stove or some sort of aroma going through the air. Absolute comfort. And that's what the hobbits are known for. It's what they do. Yeah.
Even the fact that, like you said, James, with their playing off of their homes, the fact that their homes are built into hillsides and they're completely sheltered and covered and hidden and they're tucked away, that just lends itself to the whole idea that, you know, the world goes on without acknowledging, you know, the existence of hobbits. It's like, even if you were to walk through there, at first you'd probably trip over their chimney because it's just built into a hillside.
Well, even the roundness of everything, doors, no squares, no image, you know, no sharp corners. Which was, you want to talk about the closing image, Gimli had mentioned the razor sharp rocks.
Yeah.
And that is a primary feature that I'd never noticed before in the closing image is not only were they going to danger, but to sharp edges and corners and you know, the exact opposite of that opening.
Yeah even it was intentional.
Absolutely. Yeah.
That's cool. I'm horrible at seeing stuff like that.
Oh, well then you probably missed the significance of the kind of wood that they used for their arches. No, I'm kidding. I don't know.
I was about to just drive to wherever you live.
And this is now Paul's show. The rest of us will see you on another show some other time. Thank you. Yeah, I was going to give
wait
it
till
up.
It's my movie's turn. You just wait.
Oh, yeah. Herbie the Love Bug. It's a classic.
Hey, it's supposed to be a surprise.
It would be interesting
out
to
of
do.
The bottle classic.
It would be interesting to do an old Disney, like one of those little half-off movies that they're just churning out back then. like the I don't even remember the rest of them. The original Freaky Friday, you know, that one. So opening image, we saw that. Theme stated. This is where I know I failed.
I don't think you did.
Really?
Sorry. I'm sorry. You posted something on Facebook that was not said in this show. So anyway, I think you should go ahead and tell the folks what you think.
Well, all I heard, and I could be completely wrong, is I was listening for the B story to tell the A story something, you know, somebody close. It's not necessarily the B story that says it, but Gandalf said, keep it secret, keep it safe. And that's what I kind of thought was possibly the theme, but I think is wrong now.
Okay, I'd like to retract my validation of your thought. I don't think that's correct.
You up.
Well, no, and I'm sorry.
What did
I mean, online?
I'm obviously better online. So.
Well, we'll get to that in a second. I want to voice this opinion as far as why I don't think you're right. And I'll be honest with you. Like there are some things about this movie that I am fully prepared to be wrong on, simply because it's hard for me to divorce myself from the book. And so and because I'm not a screenwriter, you know, that's a totally different way of telling stories. So there, I definitely could be, you know, could be wrong on some of this stuff. But to me, with the whole idea of keep it secret, keep it safe, that is something that is part of the story. I mean, he is supposed to keep it secret and safe throughout the whole movie, but that's not necessarily what leads to like the internal change within Frodo throughout the story. Like that's not what really carries it, because then by the time we get to halfway through the movie, well, he's surrounded by all kinds of other people that know everything about the ring. Everything right. is exposed. Everyone in Middle Earth knows about the ring. And so it's like, well, it's not secret anymore. And, you know, I mean, I guess you could say keep it protected as part of keeping it safe. But, you know, that's why I don't feel like it's the theme of
no,
the movie.
No, so. And that's why I said I'm wrong. I at the end of the movie, when ghostly Gandalf comes up and he says something to the effect of, you know, just it's all done, you know, with the reverb and the half images, but it's basically, you know, Frodo says, I just want to go home. Basically, why did this happen to me? And Gandalf says something to the effect of, it's not, you know, the time that you have, it's what you do with the time that you have.
All we have to decide is what we do with the time that is given us.
That was really close. And to what I said, and I think that was ultimately the theme. Now I went back and tried to find that and I couldn't find where it was said. But I did find a lion walking around. Mm-hmm. So
that's what I think is the theme. And here I'm not going to apologize for the whole idea of knowing the story of the book, because where it's told in the movie is not smack in the middle, but it's well after even the midpoint. They in the movie, that whole discussion takes place where Gandalf and Frodo are trying to find their way in Moria, and Frodo finally realizes that Gollum is following them. That's where they have the conversation. However, in the book, you're talking like second chapter is where that conversation actually takes place. And so as far as the book goes, the theme is stated right up front. I mean, you know, it's like I said, I mean, it's kind of hard to say as far as like page number and all that stuff, because books have a little bit more leeway than movies do. But it's way up in the front. And so one of the things that, you know, for me is always difficult with this, the movie version, is there are really key points of dialogue that the screenwriters said, okay, we have to have this in there because it's so important, and they're absolutely right. But where they choose to put it kind of throws things a little bit funky. And so that's part of the reason to me why it's so difficult to follow a lot in this story, is because they took more creative liberties than maybe they should have with certain elements. And so I think that you're right in saying that idea of, you know, when Gandalf tells him, that, you know, what was he say?
It smells. It doesn't smell as bad down this way.
Yeah, but Frodo says, I wish that the knee. Yeah, it's that whole scene, and Frodo says something like, "I wish that the ring had never have come to me." And Gandalf says, "You know, so do all who live to see such times." But yes, that's not for us to decide. We have to decide. All we have to decide is the time that is given us. And then yeah, he goes in and or continues to talk about you know, the fact that yeah, you know, Gollum has a part to play, and on and on. That gets off of the actual theme, but yeah, I do think that that is the theme, and it's just place in a really funky spot. But again, to kind of go back to what Christian was saying earlier, if you take the whole trilogy in context, that scene is probably, if you were to read or watch all the movies back to back to back, that scene is probably like in the right spot, you know? So, I mean, again, it's really kind of a difficult one, in my opinion, to pinpoint, and they don't necessarily do everything in the right order.
Well, and that makes sense, because when you watch the end of this movie, I remember when I first saw it, I remember it this time, there is not a huge finale. There is a thing that happens. Boromir obviously bites it, but there is not a huge bad guy. Yes, there is a bad guy that comes out, the Orc Eye guy, and he drives the sword deeper into his chest, which I don't know what he was trying to prove, because you're going to die after that anyway. Yeah, but again, it was kind of like the end of Empire Strikes Back, in that you're like, okay, there's going to be more later. This was just kind of all the setup, you know. This was and I realized that I was seeing two of everything. All right, so we had a little Skype out there, but basically what I was talking about was something I don't remember. So that's the important thing to take away here.
Nice.
And
perfect.
So we're moving along to the setup.
We were talking about the big picture and the little picture, and I was just saying that I found myself seeing both, and it threw me off, because in a way there was Frodo's beginning, middle, and end, his catalyst, and then there was the ring showing up in Rivendell, which was a catalyst for all of the races, and which was the catalyst for the big picture, the whole thing that started their B story. I'm sorry, not their B story, breaking to two, which for them was going to Mount Doom. So, and then I stopped for your reaction, and there was absolute quiet. So that's when,
because we were in awe of your wisdom.
Oh yeah, yeah.
You would have gotten the same reaction if we had heard you.
I pretty much did.
Sauron had a hand in this, I'm sure.
So setup wise talk to me about that. There was a lot of stuff in there. I got more notes than we got time for.
I'd love to hear them.
Oh, I just basically wrote down all the scenes, because I've come to the point where I can recognize scenes. Each scene has its own little setup. It has a problem, and then it has a solution that drives them to the next scene, which has a little setup, which has a problem, and a little solution, which drives them to the next scene. So that's basically what I have. I mean, there was this whole party deal, but ultimately the party has little to do with Frodo. They're just kind of cleaning up the transition, you know, between the opening prologue and trying to get
Frodo's a reason to leave.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, okay, so here's that part where I say, I don't completely agree. because again, if we're going back
That's
to...
That's why I just say whatever.
Well, okay, so again, thinking about what I think, you know, the theme is, and we've already talked about that, and kind of what the overall change that Frodo goes through, you know, he does have, like, he makes the decision that he's going to have to, you know, it's his fate that he must carry this ring. And Bilbo has had it for so long. So with that party, it's not only is Frodo getting this ring, but also Bilbo is gone. So the one person who has been on this kind of an adventure before is no longer in the picture. The one person who could have maybe helped out, who could have lent some wisdom, you know, is gone. Mm. So it's not just simply a way of transferring the ring, but it's also eliminating, or it's upping the stakes, you know, by eliminating, you know, another possible piece of help. Because as we all know, you know, the other people who go along this journey with him, especially in the beginning, you know, the other hobbits, they've, you know, Sam even talks about, I've never been this, or one more step and I will be the furthest I've ever been from home. Like, we're going to leave the Shire. And so, so I think that, you know, even in the movie, there's a little bit more to the party than just simply, you know, something that's just really fun and an excuse to get that classic line about liking people half as much as they deserve. So,
Right, right. Well, that's what I'm saying. I mean, they're just trying to get him out of the way. That's what I still say. I'm just the movie watcher guy. So for me, they're trying to get to the real story. They just did this whole prologue thing. Bilbo is the hero. He's got the thing, and now he's got to go away. He feels like butter spread over too much toast, and he's thin, and we're cool with that. But I never saw him as anybody that was going to help. I mean, maybe his book would have, but that's a good point. I mean, it's something I hadn't thought of. Anybody else?
No,
kind of right there with you. Yeah.
Setup also showed us a lot of stuff about the relationship that Gandalf shared with Frodo, which was even different than Bilbo and Gandalf. Gandalf kind of sees Bilbo almost as like he's the babysitter that constantly has to help Bilbo come back to his common sense, you know, what's good for Bilbo instead of what Bilbo thinks is good for Bilbo. Bilbo doesn't want to have a party. Bilbo wants to run away. He's tired of being there. He doesn't like his neighbors or his relatives or anybody. Frodo seems to just have a little bit more sense about him. But he is also boyish, you know, and childlike. He throws himself at Gandalf like you would a grandpa, you know, if you were a toddler. Which I guess size wise, you can get away with that.
Yeah. So since you brought up Gandalf, I think this is a good place to, you know, talk about, you know, the fact that there are so many main characters. You know, I won't necessarily say for the sake of the movie that he's a protagonist, but I would be curious to think or to ask you guys what you think Gandalf's flaws are.
Mm. That's good.
That's a good question. Yeah. Cause I mean, I know he's got some. But I don't know what they are.
Well, I mean, one thing we've already talked about is the fact that he can't touch the ring, and he even talks about, you know, I would use it as with a desire to do good, but through me,
right.
Yeah, it would wield the power, you know, far beyond blah blah blah, all that kind of stuff. And so, and he is short tempered with people, and throughout the movie and all that kind of stuff. So I mean, he's
a man. That's his flaw. They make that very clear in Rivendell when he says we have to trust men. You know, because the elves are leaving, there is nobody else, and then Rivendell dude goes off, Mr. Smith there goes Elrond. Off.
Anyway,
V for Vendetta goes off, and I saw it in Gandalf's face. He was offended on behalf of the men, even though he more than anyone knows, you know, the flaws of men, because even his mentor turns out to have fallen, you know, and proven him right, you know.
Yeah, well, the only thing with that is he's technically not a man, because as a wizard he's it's part of the lore is that anyway there's four wizards, blah blah blah. Anyway, we won't get into all that, but
well, they don't go to that in the movie.
I know,
in the movie,
I know.
He's a man.
I'm sorry.
In the movie he has the same ability to be tempted as all the other men.
Yeah,
and I did see it in his face. He was maybe he doesn't count himself as a man, but
Well, and the only reason why I would make
definitely
that distinction.
Definitely believes in him.
Yeah, yeah, he definitely does believe in him. The only reason why I would make that distinction is because the other wizard that we see in this movie, you know, has, you know, he goes so far to the other direction. I mean, he shows in almost in some ways that, you know, there's this opposition between innocence and experience. And the more experienced, quote unquote, people are, the more susceptible they are to the power of the ring. Whereas those that are innocent, it doesn't affect them and all that kind of stuff. And so that was the only reason why I brought up the distinction, is because Gandalf is fully aware, even before he knows, you know, that the wisest of his order has fallen and has turned, he recognizes the fact that, like, no, I cannot be anywhere, you know, I need to be as far away from this as possible, because, you know, I have potential to do more harm than anybody.
Just some playful flaws that he has is he can't do riddles worth a crap, and and his memory is cracked, which I loved. I mean, there was two spots right there. They spent forever outside of the mines, and then right after that, another scene where they're just sitting there. And I know there was a reason for that, so they could have that big conversation about pity and how Bilbo's pity is probably going to change the fate of the world and this whole thing. But it was funny to me.
Yeah,
Gandalf is flawed. So yeah, the big setup. What, anybody theories on the save the cat moment? I have found in Save the Cat, especially that moment, I used to look really hard for it. And I found that if I sit back and just enjoy the movie, the moment that I smile or that I feel something, that's usually it. And yeah. In this case, for me, it was the whole, it was that part, that first little interaction where they played this joke like they were mad at each other and a wizard shows up just when he's supposed to. And then they laugh and he throws himself at Gandalf. That's yeah. instant love for both those guys.
Yeah.
Mm. That's good. That's real yeah. good.
Even with Bilbo, the fact that he like he's got an affinity or a soft spot in his heart for kids. I mean, the fact that he adopted Frodo as his heir, and then even the scene where he's retelling the children at his birthday party, the story, essentially, mm-hmm. it's the story of the Hobbit.
Cutest kids in life.
Oh, I know, right? It's so great. I just sounded like a real dad there. But anyway, I am, so that's fine. But yeah, no, that's a good point, because I'll be honest with you, as we were watching this movie, I get so into it, I wasn't even looking for the save the cat moments. So yeah, I'm right there with you in agreement.
Yeah, there was a lot of good moments. Every character almost gets their own in this one, with the exception of Boromir. You get a hate the cat moment with him.
Can we call that the skin the cat moment?
But
it was Elrond save the cat moment.
Elrond just being there and not smiling at anything.
Would his be in the setup when they're laying the pipe in the beginning, and you see him being like the toughest warrior?
And the retelling of the story, I was there, you know, that whole thing.
I think, well, I mean, because again, I haven't really thought this through, but, you know, with Elrond, the fact that he lets Merry and Pippin and Sam go along on the journey, like the fact that they're not supposed to be there. And even though he's supposed to be making this huge world changing decision, you know, and he's got all these mighty warriors, and then he just kind of says, you know, apparently I can't, you know, you can't be kept, you know, from a secret council, even whenever he's summoned and you're not. And, you know, he allows that. So the fact that he trusts their friendship right. beyond might and wisdom and all that stuff, I think that's a save the cat moment for
and
Elrond.
All Merry and Pippin had were save the cat moments. They were the comedy relief, you know?
Yes.
They were that for the whole thing. They have a little bit more of a role, you know, there in the second movie, cause they're going to save them. But it was cool. I liked them a lot more than I did before. One of the reasons is because I got to see one of them at Dragon Con. Yeah.
What? That's awesome.
Yeah. Let's see. Billy Boyd. I saw Pippin at Dragon Con. I didn't talk to him, but yeah, it was neat.
I saw him, you know.
That's awesome.
And while it's here, cause it's in my notes, Christopher Lee, the guy that plays Saruman, when I was in LA with John and his brother, we'd gone out there to help out Ethan Nicole. I swear to you, when I stepped out in the road, a guy slammed on his brakes and was kind of mad at me and looked horribly evil, his eyebrows especially. And I went home and looked him up. It was Christopher Lee.
When we were on the set?
Yeah.
Warner Brothers?
Yeah. I think I told you. I'm like, Saruman just almost hit me with his car. So.
Do you know that he's recorded a black metal album?
Really? He's got the voice for it.
Oh, yeah.
It looks like it, too.
Yeah. He released it on his 90th birthday.
He might not even have been mad, but he just looked absolutely like I almost laid on the ground and spun around on my elbow.
You know? He was probably thinking, I didn't have a save the cat moment in that film. If I spare this man's life, they'll let me.
I'll just say this. So many times movies are guilty of doing the white is good, black is bad thing. And I know that, eventually, you know, I know that the white, the gray and the white are like levels that their Pokemons can go up to, but, it was good to see the white guy being the bad guy, you know, even in white. So.
Well, even the fact that with Gandalf in the beginning, you know, the fact that throughout the first movie, he's Gandalf the Grey, that it's like he doesn't know. It's like he's in that gray area, so to speak, kind of thing. And so anyway, yeah. So I agree. There's a lot we could talk about with colors that have nothing to do with the movie. But anyway.
Awesome. Let's see. Stasis equals death.
Obvious, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I can't stay. They know where I am. You know, I love the, I'm wanting to jump right to the debate. What was the catalyst for everybody? When he realizes he has one ring, can we agree on that?
Yeah. Yeah. Importance of the ring.
Cause homeboy goes off, gunned off, and he does the research. He comes back, you know, is it secret? Is it safe? You know? And, so the catalyst, and then immediately they go into this great debate segment that I really loved,
Yep.
Because at the time I was really looking at that keep it secret, keep it safe thing, which was a theme, but it wasn't the main theme. It was just his job, you know? And I loved that it wasn't secret anymore and that the Shire suddenly wasn't safe.
Yeah.
At all. It was horrible. And he had to get away from it, had to escape, not only for his good, but for the good of everybody there. And he does this thing, but Sauron is dead. And so he tries to deny it, you know? And then he says, well, let's just hide it. Well, it's not a secret. Well, let me give it away to you. Well, you know, it's not safe. I can't take it from you, you know? And then it cannot, well, you know, can't stay in the Shire. And as soon as he goes through all those bumps, those little things, he finally says, you know, what must I do? Literally four words. And that's your break into two, in my opinion.
Yeah. Yeah. I love this debate because I feel like it's one of the more obvious debates, mm-hmm. you know, especially in the movies that we've been discussing it, like it does go back and forth. And then there's even, because one of the other things that we've talked about with some of the other movies is that the protagonist sometimes is kind of thrown into it and he doesn't make that step. And in this one, when like what you said, James, Frodo says, you know, but it can't stay in the Shire. And Gandalf's response is, no, it can't. And so he doesn't tell Frodo, you have to take it. He says, no, it can't. And so Frodo actually makes the decision on his own, you know, at the end of the debate to move forward.
Yeah,
and so
he takes it on himself. What must I do? Not much. Exactly. What must you do? Because like I said, he tried to hide it. He tried to deny it. He tried to give it away. And boom, you know, all of his options are gone. And it was so clear and so so good. I liked it. I liked that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Any thoughts?
I was thinking that the break into two is when they're actually in that town that it's raining all the time. And they meet with Strider.
Bree? Rain Town.
Yeah.
Bree.
It's called Bree. Rain Town.
Rain Town. So that's not, I was wrong then. Never mind.
Well, because the break into two, the B story, or I'm sorry, not B story, but the two, which is supposed to be the opposite of the opener, the new world, basically, not the opposite, but the antithesis or whatever. They immediately start packing and tearing up this wonderful house. Yeah. And that's when I knew, I was like, okay, you know, we got it. Plus, boom. We get his buddy outside the window, which may not be the whole B story because they don't do a lot between Sam and dude, but he is part of it. He is part of the emotional story. I think Gandalf is. I think Samwise is, or the dude from Goonies, as I like to call him,
Mr. Frodo,
who don't could do Mr. a truffle Frodo. Shuffle in this movie. He could have easily done his own.
Wait, who is he in the Goonies?
He's the little boy with the huffer, with the puffer.
Are you serious?
Yes.
Yeah.
Get a life, Sean millennial. Austin. Goodness.
Sorry, guys.
I love the 80s, but I don't know anything about it. Oh.
I have no... Okay. We'll talk after.
Yeah, he was also Ferris Bueller.
No, oh, I'm messing so
with I'm messing with you now. So
he was
the
lion.
He was the girl.
Every person in the cast of 16 Candles.
Oh, Molly Ringwald.
So the B story is called the love story. What do you think the B story was for this? The emotional side of things, because there was a love story, but it was a brief thing, and I don't think it really was anything. You know.
Well, I mean, I think you know with breaking the two. You know, and B story, like they, I mean, like we've talked about before, they kind of, you know, go together and they ebb and flow. You know, we've, like you guys have already said, you know, we see them tearing up the house and packing, but we have that moment we've discussed where they do take that step outside of, or, you know, further than Sam's ever been. Mm-hmm. So we've already met Sam, but we met a lot, you know, the other two hobbits as well, but we actually see them really involved now. You know, so we're in some ways it's kind of like we're really bringing those B story characters in hardcore now with, you know, Sam already going with him, with Merry and Pippin, you know, bumping them into them on the shortcut to mushrooms, which by the way, I will have to say one of the cool things about this movie is they work in the chapter titles of the book into the dialogue, which is always really fun. But yeah, anyway,
that's cool.
But then there's another B story that comes in as well, and it kind of goes along with, you know, when with what John said with them getting to Bree, but we see Strider,
yeah,
and he plays a really important role, and there is a, you know, a buddy love, you know, kind of relationship, because that's, you know, what in Save the Cat, you know, Blake Snyder even talks about how romances are really just buddy love movies, like in disguise or whatever. And mm-hmm. so even that, so with Strider also, like, so we see, you know, a number of different characters introduced right then and there that are going to carry us, you know, through the rest of the story.
Right. Yeah, it was good. B story, I thought, was a lot of Gandalf though, because Gandalf was the one, he was the, what do you call it? The foundation, or the point of reference for him, his guardian, his helper, his guide, you know, his safety, his protector. And mm-hmm. And plus every deep conversation that they had pretty much was between the two of them.
Yeah.
But you're right, Strider had his own story, but that's because in the big story, in the whole movie, he becomes absolutely essential. You know, he's huge. He's right. The dang king.
Yeah.
So
well, even in this one, there's some interaction between him and Frodo that I think is important as far as Frodo's, you know, character development and all that kind of stuff. And, you know, another thing with B story is the fact that it's kind of the world turned upside down. You know, mm-hmm. we're in a completely different world. So lending itself back to, or that thought lending itself back to what Christian talked about earlier, where in the opening image, we, you know, we see everybody sitting, but now everyone's, you know, standing. It's a lush green pasture. The sun is shining, but then like Christian said, it's raining in this town. So it's like everything about this world is different. They're no longer in the Shire. It's like literally everything has been turned upside down, leading us into, you know, into the B story.
Yeah, I don't remember seeing any of that.
Well, and then you've got them hiding underneath the tree, which they're underneath the earth, so to speak, and the Wraith, you know, is coming close. I love the bugs coming out of the woodwork, you know, just and
they're afraid.
But then when they get to Bree and they're up in their beds, so all snug and safe. I love how the indoors now are not safe. It's you know, the things that hobbits find the most dear, very dangerous. And they spend the rest of the time outside, you know, other than, I would even count Moria outside just for, you know, storytelling purposes, because it was just as dangerous.
Yeah.
The long dark. Good way to look at it. The long dark. All right. So A is the physical, B is the emotional action. It's what Ethan said. Any other big emotional things happening here? We see Strider. We see his love story. We see, you know, I was surprised. I did not remember there being so little between Sam and Frodo. You know, I remember looking back, I was like, oh, they're buds. They're, you know, tight. But Sam does all of his stuff right at the end, you know, when he's mm-hmm. freaking willing to drown, you know, to prove his faithfulness, you know, and stupidity, honestly, blind stupidity, which is, again, their fault, but also their strength.
Well, but there's also the scene when they're in the corn where Sam kind of freaks out and Frodo's like, hey, what are you freaking out about? And he says, you know, he told me something before we left. And he said, don't you leave him, Samwise Gamgee.
That's right.
And so, you know, even up front, like, he establishes the fact that it's like, no, he is dedicated and he's worried about Frodo, you know, even in the beginning. But I will agree that, you know, there's a lot of, or they could have done more to strengthen that bond in the beginning parts of this movie, even though, you know, I feel like it's there. It's just
in the extended version, you see more of that.
Oh, yeah.
And matter of fact, when they were cooking bacon and crap right there at the beginning and start seeing all these glowing people walking through the woods there, and they start talking about how the elves are leaving, which I remember from the book, I was like, I'm watching the extended version. I'm not doing this. This thing's 4 hours long. You know, I'll never get to the podcast at this rate. So I went back to my DVD and found my theatrical release that wouldn't fit on a DVD. But all right. Fun and games. It's always good stuff. At this point, just let's take 5 minutes and bump through some of our favorite moments from the trailer. Because this is where you get your trailer from.
The two wizards fighting is awesome. Yeah. That's one thing that is like, when we talked about, you know, translating from book to film, that's not, you know, that doesn't happen in the book. And it should have, because they made it so epic in the movie. It's like every time I see it, I'm just like, oh, it's so great.
Yeah,
so
you just don't see old men getting slammed into walls exactly. very often. And I loved it. It was so real and authentic and well done.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was very subdued in a way, too. You know, there wasn't a lot of like sparks and like CGI. And mm-hmm. honestly, like, it really.
That's what I'm saying. It was real. There were people being thrown up against the wall. And you don't even see that in Star Wars. Two old men fighting with swords, and they're just kind of. These guys went all out, man. And I made a joke earlier that went unheeded about spinning on your elbow. There's a great, you know, full on basically recreation prop of him, you know, spinning on his elbow there in the middle. And it's very, very good. It took me a couple times to realize I wasn't looking at a real man being spun. You'll have to see it. It's just
really,
yeah, it looks like something at Disney World that you would see going through, you know, in a car or something.
It looks like if you don't have any context and you just watch that scene for like the first couple of seconds, you probably think it was just the start to like a dance battle.
They're breakdance fighting.
Yeah.
I love Merry and Pippin. I love the fireworks, the dragon fireworks, the whole thing. I know that's technically part of setup, but it was definitely fun and games. I loved the old man at the door, at the gate, you know, who you thought was really tough and bad. And he's like, "Don't get upset, sirs. I'm just doing my job." And then, poor guy gets crushed. I mean, by the gate and the riders. I love the nails. I'm just going to keep going until somebody cuts in. The nails going through the hooves with the blood trickling down on the riders' horses. Yeah. And then when they get washed away, I had a question. I was like, are horses bad too? If your rider is bad, are you automatically bad as well?
Yes.
Do you deserve to get washed away?
And if by the horse water and horses, the rider.
And if you have, that's true. If you have red eyes, yes, you are bad. So.
I like the swords. The swords was good.
Yeah.
Arrows was good. magic was good.
And, I like when Mad Max came out on the way to Thunderdome.
I'm just glad there was no dudes. What's what was the guy in Lord of the Rings? The first dude that she meets with the little goat feet.
You're talking about Lion...
Mr. Tumnus. Yeah, I'm just glad no Mr. Tumnus's was there. You know why? Because of the nipples. I can't stand...
Hey, I actually have a joke about, like, centaur nipples.
Good.
Do you think centaur... It's not really a joke. It's just like, what do you think centaur babies... Do you think, like, they breastfeed from the human part or the centaur part?
Oh, that's horrible. It just depends on how they're sleeping, I guess.
Okay.
It's nice to know that there's other options.
Yeah, I didn't ever think about that. I love the breakfast and second breakfast and secondsies and tea and, you know, just the fact that hobbits eat constantly.
Yeah.
That's why they're round. That's why they have to have round doors. Saruman builds an army. Orcs are tearing up trees. The roots grow deep, master. Rip them out. And I was like, dang, I didn't know you ripped up trees, dude. Wow. You know, if you went to a tree doctor, they would systematically remove the branches and cut the thing down and then grind the stump. But they're ripping these jokers out of the ground, these old trees, which in the book was a bad thing because trees have a soul, you know, and they can whisper and the Ents, you know, are connected with them and all that. And that does play out later on. Yeah, but
right. That's huge.
But the whole go ahead.
Was it Paul was talking about how like he did kind of portray like technology as the evil there? I hope I'm not getting ahead of myself.
No, go for it.
Well, they talk about how like before, all the good guys, all like pretty natural, you know, real earthy. And then the bad guys are like ripping out trees to make these giant war machines and all this stuff.
Oh yeah. There's
the story sort of portrays technology. I guess it's in the book more as being like an evil, kind of because.
Or just metalwork in general. Just any kind of blacksmithing, is pretty bad because you have to burn trees, and growing cabbage patch orchi is just a pretty gross business.
Yeah,
just put them in the ground and they come up and you adopt them and you get a little certificate and take them to school.
Yeah,
That's why Saruman's all in white. He's like the mirror image of an Apple product. So the technology is bad.
Except with hair.
We're really getting deep into it now. Yeah.
Yeah. See, he's one of those jerks behind the Genius Bar.
You'll notice he always has an iPod.
Yep.
In every scene. Yeah. He's got his earbuds in.
Yeah, can we start a slow clap for John?
That was
awesome.
You're welcome.
Yeah.
So that was my favorite part.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard for me to say what's my favorite part, and you know, the whole promise of the premise thing, you know, that we're at this point. I mean, they're obviously on the road, and we get the awesome scene on Weathertop, which, by the way, according to the Middle Earth calendar of the story, they arrived on Weathertop on October 6th, which is my birthday. But yay, anyway, nerd alert. But yeah, well, happy birthday, whatever. But so even that, like, that's something from, you know, that scene where, like, you know, the Wraiths are walking towards Frodo with the, you know, big crazy swords and all that stuff. And so,
yeah, he gets stabbed.
Yeah.
And it will never fully heal. And he gets green goop coming from his eyes and his nose, which Boromir gets on his face later on. It's like, if you're going to die, you get green crap on your face. That's just the rule in Middle-earth.
Yeah, and then you already talked about the black riders being on the black horses and everything, but I always love the scene where the water comes over the ford and the water is in the form of horses and it destroys them. It's like that part is so awesome, and especially because it's Arwen that. Sorry, I get a little choked up because she's beautiful and awesome in this movie, and so
yeah, I can't look at her without thinking about her dad. So. Mr. Tyler there. Yeah.
Well, I can, but my wife's wedding dress was actually modeled after one of the dresses that Arwen wears.
That her dad wore?
Yeah. That her dad wore, probably, yeah.
That's awesome.
I remember her from the blowing up the asteroid movie, Armageddon.
Yeah, so, that was a piece of crap.
Dripping ice in her belly button, and I wanted to vomit. So,
I would like to clarify one thing real quick. When I say that my wife, like, that her wedding dress was modeled after that, she's gorgeous and awesome. And, you know, I think nerd and geek is a good term, but she's not any of those things. Mm. She just did that because she loves me. So that proves, like, that her love runs deep enough to alter or to do something like that.
My wife wears a Liv Tyler mask too. That's crazy.
That's well, that's weird. I think we need to shut the podcast down and have a different talk. But.
No, I love the my favorite fight scene is the one he has that Strider has when he fights, like, what is it, five of them at that point, or seven of them or something? Yeah, I think it's five. And the fire. I just love all the fire, and they catch on fire and they slam into each other. Wraiths don't like fire, and that one that he throws it right in their face and it sticks, and then it's obviously a puppet that's running away, but I still love it. I think they did so good hiding that fact. And the whole thing. I love being able to see them through Bilbo's eye or Frodo's eyes and
all the gray. And
I gotta say, I'm really slow. Even though I read the book, even though I've seen the movie a few times, I do remember it took me a couple times before I made the correlation, even though they even say it, kind of, sort of, they don't actually come out and say that these were the men that got the rings, you know, these were the kings. And, so I love that they let you find that out on your own. So, but Frodo gets Sting, which is awesome. Glows blue. Well, I know that's after midpoint, but all right, let's jump to midpoint. I would say midpoint, I kind of struggled between whether it was when they first got there, because, you know, Frodo's healed, they get reunited, everybody's dancing and stuff. But then I'm like, no, you know what? The midpoint for me, I'm going to say, is when the council is formed and they're just standing there ready to go. And they say the Fellowship of the Ring. Boom. What do you think, guys?
All right. Yeah, I have exactly that. I put, it would be funny if they all looked into the camera, right, as, you know, when they said Fellowship of the Ring.
It said midpoint. James, yeah, this is midpoint. Thank you. Thank you, Elrod.
Well, that's the closest thing to a party, too. So
exactly. Thank you, John. That's exactly what I was going to say, is that Ethan's advice from last time was that a lot of times there's a party or a big kiss or something. It is like, you know, it's a new gathering. It's like a party. And so, yeah, I'm glad that you noticed that, John, and I wasn't the only one.
Cool.
One does not just walk into the midpoint, though. I just wanted to point that out. So
that's true.
Thank you, Boromir. Bad guys close in. I thought it was pretty obvious, because even though the army had been building, even though we'd seen, you know, Saruman and Gandalf go at it, the group, even the hobbits, even though they had had some, you know, back and forth with the wraiths, it wasn't like it was after Rivendell, where, you know, the crows come almost immediately, even though they don't do anything, they're heading straight for, you know, Saruman, and they fly down, you know, into the pit and the whole nine yards. We got the snowy mountains. Feel free to break any time. I'm just filling time.
I think that before we skip over, before we leave midpoint, one thing we haven't talked about is, you know, is this the, you know, great moment or the awful moment? Because, I mean, that's going to play in later on. We've got to have the mirror image. And so we haven't talked about, you know, beyond it just being a gathering and beyond the fact that, yes, it is the midpoint, why it's actually the midpoint.
Okay. Feel free to fill in that content, because you just created it.
Okay. Well, I mean, so in the beginning of the movie, like, or with the catalyst, like, Frodo has to start off all on his own. And so to me, this is the false hope. This is, everything is great, but it's a false great. You know, because now it's like, oh, I don't have to go it alone. I don't have to deal with all this on my own. I've got the whole fellowship behind me. You know, he even talks about, you know, the fact that I don't know the way. Jumping back to when we talked about the catalyst, his question was, you know, what must I do? And so now it's no longer an I, it's a we. And so in some ways, they're kind of ratcheting everything up to where it's like, okay, now we're beginning our descent into the final half of the movie. But he's also able to breathe a little bit easier, because he's no longer, you know, feeling like this is something that he has to do on his own.
Okay. Is that it?
Yeah.
Duly noted.
All right. Bad guys close in, evil crows, snowy mountains, all that stuff. I'm just trying to keep us going. We gotta finish up eventually. Mines of Moria. Good stuff. Tons and tons of just issues where people are closing in on them.
Trolls.
Yeah. We got the orcs, the people, even the Kraken in the water there. With the tentacles that can bite you like tremors, you know, constantly bad guys attacking them. No stopping. Every scene has somebody coming after them. Even the foundations of the place, the stairs and stuff, are bad guys closing in. They can't get a break. They can't stop. It's the best part of the movie for me. That huge fight with the cave troll. I mean, cave trolls don't need a brain to function, apparently, because am I wrong? Legolas puts an arrow right in his head,
his brainstem or something.
Yeah, yeah. and then he takes another shot, and he even tries to shake it off, like, you know, so
that didn't hurt.
Yeah, and even in Harry Potter, trolls were painted kind of the same way. They had on clothes, but you just clunk them on the head or stick a wand up their nose, and it messes them up. So
don't matter.
And this is where it starts getting messy for me, and I will claim no knowledge or anything like that. Obviously the Balrog, the bridge, we're closing in on the end of bad guys close in and hitting up against All Is Lost. I put, Fly You Fools as All Is Lost, the whiff of death. Am I wrong?
Yes. No, you're not wrong. That's right. Sorry.
John, what do you think?
Yes, I think because that's where it goes. Everything goes from great to awful.
I want to say this.
And him falling down the hole is pretty awful.
I also thought that possibly Boromir dying was the whiff of death, because there's so much that happens at the end. And to take in All Is Lost at this moment means that there's an awful lot going on during the Dark Night of the Soul. An awful lot.
Yeah.
We're talking about the mirror scene. We're talking about the you know, all this stuff is going on before they recoup with a fresh idea and break into three. So, Paul, set us straight.
Yeah, I think you guys are already on the right path. I mean, All Is Lost is, you know, Gandalf dying. Again, you know, to kind of talk about, you know, universal story structure, you know, think about Star Wars. That All Is Lost moment is when Obi-Wan dies. Mm-hmm. And in this one, it's the mentor that dies. And one thing that I forgot to throw in when I was talking about midpoint is in the first, well, I mean, it goes with All Is Lost, but because it's that mirror image, you know, where in the beginning, or he's got Gandalf now, because in the beginning it's, you know, you've got to go, you got to get rolling, and he doesn't have Gandalf to be a part of his crew. And then at the midpoint, he does have Gandalf along with all these other people, and now he doesn't anymore. So not only is he dead, but it's also, like I said, it plays into the whole mirror image part. So
good deal. Dark Night of the Soul then is, you know, they cry right there at the beginning, right there. I mean, they have this big response, but the guy from Prisoners gets them going, tells them, we got to get out of here, we got to go. Then they meet elves in the woods, and you know, the elf queen lady, what's her name again there, Paul?
Galadriel.
Blanchett.
Galadriel. That sounds like a something that trash bags would be made out of in the future, but
sounds cool, like, man. the end of a Knock Knock joke. Sorry, that's even worse. Yeah,
I love that Kate scene Blanchett. Though it reminds me of the Pensieve in Harry Potter. But he gets to look in there, and he sees, you know, his friends dying and all this kind of stuff. But I love her. She speaks over him, or actually over them, allows them to rest and get things going. And then she has to face the ring as well.
That part scares the crap out of me.
She is scary, man. She's so pretty, though. Classically beautiful. I love her in this scene.
Yeah. So.
I'm not feeling it. I don't think she's that pretty.
Whatever.
I mean, that's not important to the podcast, but.
It's important to the break into three.
Well, so have we established, or I want to hear what everybody thinks is Dark Night of the Soul.
I think it's the whole thing.
They get out of the mountain.
I think once Elf Lady passes the test, and you know, the break into three is obviously the last page of Dark Night of the Soul, so I'll mention what I think that is. She says even the smallest person can change the course of the future, and that is the thing that she needs to get, or he needs to get on with his life. He's given a vision, encouragement, and he's given a light, a little thing in a bottle, and they're sent on their way. Break into three. But I could be completely wrong. But that would. But what threw me off here is the movie's so long. There's so many scenes in each one of these segments that it's not typical. You know what I'm saying? Yeah. You watch Back to the Future. There's three scenes in each one or whatever that you would highlight. This one, my notes are 7 pages long because there's so much going on in each one. So Dark Night of the Soul is a long road for them.
Yeah. And I think that you're, you know, the scene right outside of Moria, you know, they do have that moment, you know, where they are mourning and everything. That is a Dark Night of the Soul. But I think another one that you have already talked about as well is a very specific one is when Frodo is looking into the mirror, because he does see, you know, you talk about Whiff of Death. He mm-hmm. sees that, you know, this is what could be. And he sees Sam in shackles, and he sees the whole Shire on fire, and every, you know, the whole world being destroyed. So, I mean, that's a really prominent.
With no context. She tells him later, this is what happens if you fail. But,
yeah, but
when you're
but
watching
him,
it for him, yeah, he thinks this
yeah,
is
exactly.
reality. This is his worst fear. This plays into what they said about him is his heart is with the Shire. That's what. Frodo said to Gandalf about him is one of his flaws was his heart was in the Shire.
And exactly. So, yeah, I agree completely. And that's why I think that specifically, like if I could only choose one, I would say that is the Dark Night of the Soul. You know, because yeah, for all the reasons that you just said.
Only though, Dark Night of the Soul is 75 to 85. So it's all of this. It's all of this. It's everything from, all the way from that moment where he dies, the all is lost, to break into three. So yes, absolutely agree. The crying, the suffering, all the way through the elf lady test. It's all Dark Night of the Soul. Good.
Yeah.
Cause I was a little thrown. Cause usually it's not that long. You know? And in Spider-Man 2, it wasn't that long. He got over a lot quicker than he should have, you know? Breaking at 3, I think we already said it, but, you know, he's given an encouragement, a light, and they're setting out on the water in their elvish... A golden what?
He's got to go it alone.
Oh,
he decides go it alone.
Well, no, he's still with his guys, though, isn't he, at this point? They're almost about to split up, but they're in their little leaf-shaped boats.
Yes. Yeah.
And they're heading toward, past these giant, figures, which I'm sure Paul knows everything about them, including what's up their skirts and everything.
And they, genitals.
Yes. And they pull off to the side before going off the cliff there, which is just a waterfall in disguise. And then I guess I'm saying the finale kicks in right there. I mean, everything at the end, the big orcs coming to get them, Boromir failing his test, Frodo deciding he's leaving, Strider proving himself, you know, after Boromir did not.
When are we going to get to call him Aragorn? Or Aragorn. Oh, gosh. Sorry, guys.
Aragorn. We can call him whatever you want. Merry and Pippin getting captured. Aragorn fights the leader of the Orcai. Sam goes after Frodo. Frodo remembers what Gandalf says about the time he has. So all of that is finale. So to cut just to the end, because there's not much to say about that unless you're not me. Final image. Let's spend our last few minutes talking about that final image. I said it earlier, razor sharp rocks, danger ahead, but his friend is now his comfort. His friend has taken the place because he has the best part of the Shire with him at the end scene.
Aww. That's cool.
I sound like Paul there, didn't I?
Yeah, that was really good.
I'm proud of myself, but Paul,
me too.
Beat me up.
No, I just thought Paul dropped out for a second.
No, I'm here. Yeah, okay. Yeah.
That's anyway. The only reason why I'm right is when he's off.
No, I mean, to be honest with you, I'm sorry to do this, but I feel like we're kind of brushing past part of the finale. Because I mean, we've talked about Frodo being, the protagonist, and we're talking about his development and all that kind of stuff. And so with the finale, to me, I want to hear your thoughts on this, but we don't meet the Orcai until 5 minutes before the battle scene. So it's like, they're part of, the dark, the enemy's army and all that stuff, and they are an antagonist, but there's not really anything invested as far as them. And so it's like that scene to me is more just, well, it's a Hollywood movie and there's fighting, and so we need to have a big fight scene.
Yep.
At the end.
But it
end.
Feels empty though.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And so to me, that's great, and it's a fun scene and really awesome. But as far as the finale, to me, it's more it's kind of a double bump, so to speak, for the finale, where Frodo realizes that whenever he is when Aragorn lets him go, that he tells Merry and Pippin, no, don't follow me, by shaking his head. And so he's making that decision once again that, no, if I'm, this task has been entrusted to you or to me alone, so he's making that decision. And so the fight, the struggle there is him, again, realizing that this task is up to him. And so he's fighting that urge and that necessity or that need for companionship and all that kind of stuff. And that's why it's called the breaking of the fellowship, there at the end. So it's not only him, telling Merry and Pippin, no, you can't come with me. But then even there, whenever he's out in the canoe, my favorite line of this whole movie is when Frodo says, no, Sam, go back. I must go to Mordor alone. And Sam's response is, of course you do, but I'm coming with you. And he actually stops and he lets, Sam come with him, kind of thing. Which leads right into that final image, like you said, James, where he does take the best part of the Shire with him. He does take that innocence along with him. His weakness, quote unquote, does end up being, his strength there at the end.
Good deal. Any other comments about the final image?
Well said.
Nothing. Yeah, you summed it up. I knew I was going to be quiet this whole podcast. Except for my stupid Aragorn joke that fell on its face.
What? Oh,
I like the other one that fell on its face. The nipple joke. So
it wasn't even a joke. I'm sure you're going to edit that out later. But that's just
now he's going to play it on a loop.
Yeah, that's it's the whole podcast.
It's my new ringtone.
It's good stuff. It's good stuff. Did you enjoy it more this time with the Save the Cat eyeball?
I enjoy it more every time I watch it. That's not a fair question to ask me.
Here's a real question. How many times did you actually watch it for the preparation here, Paul?
I watched it 4 times. And then while I was working today, I just had it playing in the background. So I didn't really watch it today because I was working. Cough, cough, wink, wink. So, dude, I'm telling you, like, if I were to tell you how much I love these movies, you would think that they are my wedding vows. It's like I watch them whenever I'm sick, I watch them whenever I'm healthy, when I've had no money, this is my entertainment. When I have lots of money, I would rather be watching this movie or reading the book. You know, it's pretty awesome. Pathetic. Like it's a wonder. Yeah, exactly.
Would you watch it with a cat? Yes, I would. So what did it do wrong? What did it do right? We don't have a lot of time left, so I'll just say that what I heard us say is the theme was stated kind of late in the movie. It might have been better served to have had it there. We would have loved to have seen a little bit more Sam interaction. And then the ending was a little hollow because they kind of shoved in. They had to get these guys in there before the next movie. And I agree with that, especially the ending. I never noticed the other stuff until I watched it this time through. But
what other stuff?
The thing about Sam, I always thought there was more there than really was. Mm-hmm. And I think they made up for it at the end during the finale there. But I just thought there was more moments. But I guess I was thinking about the second and third movie because, you know, when we're on a sheer mountain cliff making bacon and stuff, you know, there's a lot of that. There's a lot of that. But he's not even the B story then, in my opinion. But we'll talk about that some other time when we never do another Lord of the Rings movie because they're so long.
He's so long.
Any final remarks, John?
No, I had a tough time because I spent so much time watching it. But it's just such a – tying into all the other two or seven or 12, it's tough to really kind of follow for me. So that's what I'll say.
Okay. Polly?
Yeah. I mean, I I love these movies. I definitely, you know, to me, the biggest thing that they did wrong is something that I don't know how else they would have done it, but there's so much going on that it's impossible to fit everything into a movie. And, you know, there are so many things that, again, because I've read the book so many times, it infuses my understanding of the movie to where, you know, I feel more of a connection between certain characters and, you know, different things that are there that it's like, yeah, I mean, just watching the movie, it's not able to be there. And so I love whenever somebody tells me, oh yeah, I love the Lord of the Rings movies. And we begin to talk about that stuff. And when they do ask questions, getting to like fill them in on certain things and they're like, oh, okay, well that makes more sense and blah, blah, blah.
Gee,
and
I can't wait to watch it
next time. Yeah.
It's been 3 hours.
No, that's just women. But anyway, that's why my wife lets me go to the bar alone. She knows that I'll end up talking about this, but yeah, no, I mean, but again, I think that is, you know, to me, that's the only thing they did wrong was they weren't able to get everything in that was necessary. And again, I don't know how they would have done that in the first place. So I applaud them for what they were able to do.
So even in the extended versions, which I'm sure you own and have seen and have memorized, did they do any better with that?
No, not really. I mean, the extended scenes are great. And then, you know, it's just them getting some gifts in Lothlorien and all that. And there's this great thing where Gimli gets a strand of hair from Galadriel. And it's stuff that plays more into the book story. But again, taking just the movies in context, I'm, you know, the fact that they got rid of those scenes, it's like, well, yeah, that's totally fine. You don't lose anything in the movie experience by not watching the extended one. So
I agree. Christian.
Man, I don't know. Is there anything left to say? It was good. It was long. And that made it kind of hard to save the cat or to beat it down. Rather, I am sort of used to the movies being like, oh, here's one and here's two and here's three and here's four.
I agree
four.
With you. Yeah. It was hard.
With the gaps, I found myself going back and editing it. I actually played it on my TV and then on my laptop at the same time. You know, like, and I would play them at different parts and mute one so I could like see where I was at. You know what I mean?
Right. I was constantly getting interrupted, you know, just, it took me 2-3 days just to watch it one time through, which has made it even harder because I got kids. I'm home with them all day, you know, that kind of thing. So
when we do these movies, I try to watch it twice. But with this one, I just said, nope. Like, it's, I'll watch it once and then that'll have to be good enough.
Yeah, when I found it, when I realized I was watching the extended version, if you could have heard me in here, I was yelling. I'm like, nope, not doing this. No. Well, guys, that's it for today. Consider, listeners, consider supporting Movie Beatdown. If we have added value to your life, if you have in any way found any value, we would appreciate a quarter per episode, just $1 a month. You can visit moviebeatdown.com/donate and do a one time, or get on with Patreon and do it, you know, help us out monthly, $1 a month. Everybody can do that. Next time, Paulie, what are we going to be watching?
Oh, we're doing Paranorman.
Woohoo.
Yeah, yeah.
Who has not seen that? I have.
I have not.
I have not.
So Christian has not.
John has not.
Paul?
This will be our first animated.
Yeah, it's true. Stop motion, too. Traditionally stop motion, which I respect highly.
Yeah. I love this movie.
Yeah, these are the same guys that are doing Box Trolls, which my son is about to chew through the wall to see. He's never been passionate about a movie like he is Box Trolls.
Nice.
Mm. Wants to see it so bad. They were making box. They butchered one of our moving boxes to make a Box Troll costume for him, and that he could get inside. So he's still miniature enough to be able to do it. Guys, it's on Netflix. Paranorman is streaming on Netflix. If you haven't seen it, go to our website and comment on this episode and find out more about Save the Cat at moviebeatdown.com. You can email your comments and suggestions, especially movie suggestions, to moviebeatdown@gmail.com. Our Twitter is, guess what, @moviebeatdown. That's all for John, Paulie, and Christian. Thank you so much, guys. We'll see all of you next time right here on Movie Beatdown.
Can we go over the rest of my notes off the air?
Visit NLCast.com for other great NLCast network shows.